Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Support for Trans Positive comes from KBOO members and RelationshipGardening.com, specializing in support and repair for couples. Virtual for Oregon and California. Information at couplescoach@gmail.com.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say.
Good evening and welcome to Trans Positive. Tonight we're going to be talking mostly about the recent Olympics. Let's go around and introduce ourselves. My name is Nicolette and I use they, them pronouns.
My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
I'm Sheila. I'm transgender, so I use she, her.
Great, thank you. So what I'd like to discuss tonight is the recent story about Imane Khelif. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and particularly the transphobia surrounding it. So Imane is a professional female boxer from Algeria who recently competed in the 2024 Summer Olympics. And the controversy surrounding her performance in the Olympics started when she fought against Angela Carini of Italy, and Angela surrendered 46 seconds into the match after two blows, which she claimed was because her nose was hurting. Rumors then began circulating online that Imane was a trans woman. This was partially due to Imane not having a traditionally feminine appearance, but was also caused by Imane's previous disqualification from the 2023 IBA Women's World Boxing Championship, where it was alleged that Imane had failed unspecified gender tests, but there has been no evidence that any such tests were actually performed. The IBA refuses to state exactly what tests were performed, and the Algerian Olympic Committee has stated she was disqualified due to medical reasons. It has also been stated by the International Olympic Committee that Imane is a cisgender woman, and it's even illegal to be trans in her home country. So, aside from the rumor that Imane is trans, there have also been rumors circulating that Imane is intersex and was born with XY chromosomes but an otherwise female body, but that has not been confirmed either. And either way, there have been millions of transphobes cyberbullying her and calling for her to be disqualified, whether they believe she's trans or intersex. So the conversation surrounding this is how transphobia is affecting not just trans people, but also cis and intersex people. Like how transphobes have suddenly moved their goalposts from, if you were born with a vagina, you're a woman, and if you were born with a penis, you're a man, to, oh, even if you were born with a vagina, you're still a man if you have XY chromosomes. So what are your thoughts on this?
Would you like to go first, Sheila?
Well, the thing that bothers me the most is that, especially in boxing, it's usually weight classifications, but, you know, there's so many factors in play in boxing as a sport, the length of reach for one thing. And so the real problem is that this is just one more occasion to portray trans people as not only unfair, but in this case, as brutalizing the other sex. In fact, I heard one thing of saying this was just a case of another case of a man beating up on a woman. And it couldn't have happened in a more evocative way, because she quit, her opponent quit within 1 minute of beginning the bout, and then left in tears, and then refused to shake hands at the time. So everything implied that this was not a victory. And of course, this is anything in sports is by its definition somewhat atypical. What do you do with somebody like Michael Phelps, who has very large feet that are almost like swim fins, and therefore does incredible times that nobody had ever seen before at the time? How do you weed out talent, size, strength? There's so many different factors, and every sport is going to be somewhat differently interpreted. But the thing that is so sad in this case is that I have a feeling that genitalia would not have come into play, even if it turns out, and I'm still a little vague on it, that this boxer is cisgender. Even then, it was almost like we're saying we have different classes of what we think is appropriate for a woman, so that even a cisgender who appears to be trans would be as stigmatized as if she was in fact trans. And this is another avenue to the same thing. But I'm noticing a lot of things. This is not pornography, but this is just pictures that show up on the internet of fashions. And I'm noticing curves that prior to this, nobody had curves like this. In other words, we're not satisfied with just being a woman. We have women who are so curvy that you honestly wonder if they've had work done, because it's almost like, it's almost as though, as the social anxiety surrounding appearances grows more suspicious of anything in between, it says the only way we'll resolve this is to be so absolutely hyper feminine and hyper masculine that the two can never be confused. So they're basically making a war on in other words, if this was a bell curve, they're actually having more problems with people in the middle than with people at the ends, because at least the ends are identifiable, and that takes away their anxiety.
So I think that, Imani Khalif is a cisgender woman. She was assigned female at birth. And I just think that in alignment with what Sheila said, there's a wide variance of different kinds of body types. When you look at people in the Olympics, especially swimmers, swimmers develop really strong upper bodies. And they're very, very muscular. I think about female bodybuilders and how amazingly muscular they are. And there's just certain things that the body does. The body just does certain things. And if you're a boxer and you work out and you're doing a lot of boxing, you're going to develop a certain kind of body type. And we think that only, that women, even if they're athletes, cisgender women, if they're athletes, still have to look a certain kind of way. But it's really interesting, because the Olympics, we don't do that with other sports. In almost all of the sports, they're sort of tailored toward people with different kinds of body types. The gymnasts, for the longest time, they were getting shorter and shorter. and smaller because it was easier to do the things that got good scores. I mean, it's changed in the last few years where gymnasts don't have to be quite so tiny anymore as they were like back in the 80s. But that's still there. You know, I mean, when you look at long jumpers, I mean, people with really long legs obviously have a huge advantage, or people who do the high jump, I mean, tend to be really lean and tall. I mean, those are just benefits that they have for the position. So, I mean, Imani Kelly was, you know, just is just a good boxer. And, you know, she just had a really quick hand and she won. But, you know, J.K. Rowling certainly didn't miss a beat. You know, J.K. Rowling went on this transphobic tirade right away against Imani Kelly. And in return, Imani Kelly filed a suit against J.K. Rowling, you know, claiming damages. And I'm not sure exactly where that's at. The last I heard was...
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I do have somewhat of an update on that. I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on with the suit at this point, other than she filed it. But I do know that for about 2 weeks after she filed the lawsuit, J.K. Rowling just like completely stopped posting on Twitter for about 2 weeks. And so everyone was like, okay, we need to give Imani another medal for finally getting J.K. Rowling to shut up. But then just a couple days ago, I think, after about a 2 week silence, J.K. Rowling broke her silence and posted on Twitter again, asking or calling for Imani to post her DNA test results, her chromosome test results, proving that she is a cis woman. And I'm just like, JoJo, have you learned nothing?
Mm-hmm. What happened to J.K. Rowling? It was, I remember back in the 80s, you know, everybody thought J.K. Rowling was just, you know, she was the hottest thing in writing.
And was it the 80s or the 90s?
The 90s, yeah, and she became a billionaire.
Yeah.
You know. And then here's what she did with it, you know, she used her money and her power to marginalize an even already marginalized group. It just makes you wonder, you know. I mean, here's this person who worked really hard her whole life to be a boxer, and she works her way up and she gets all the way to the Olympics, wins a gold medal, and she just can't even enjoy her victory because of transphobes like J.K. Rowling. It's just, it's a shame. I mean, there's all kinds of people in sports. And, you know, even if somebody was intersex, I mean, does that mean they're not supposed to perform? I mean, I'm not even saying she is. I mean, Imani Khalif says she's a cisgender woman. Her birth certificate says she's cisgender. You know, why can't she perform? Why can't she compete in sports? We reward other athletes for, you know, their superior skill. Charles Barkley, who's just about to retire from the NBA. I mean, part of the reason that he's so rich and he's so famous is because he's so tall. He's like a tall, big, muscular man. And he's like so much taller than a lot of the other people that he, you know, that he performs with, but we don't say, oh, he can't be in sports because he's tall. So why do we have problems with women who are strong? You know, I mean, why is this an issue? It's because people associate boxing with masculinity, and so if there's someone who is boxing and they're strong and they're good, It's too much for transphobes. They just can't handle it. It's like their brain explodes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there is the issue that regardless of if she is trans or if she is intersex, she should still be allowed to compete in the division, the women's division anyway. But then on top of that, she's not, as you know, she's not trans. We don't know for sure she's intersex. She appears to be cis as far as we know, and yet she's still got people asking for her to be disqualified. So that's why, you know, transphobia isn't even just affecting trans people.
Yeah.
I think if I can add something here, I think that the saddest thing is that it's invalidating from two different directions. One narrative says the reason that this person is competing is because they should have been classified as male, but couldn't really measure up, and so would not have won any titles in that division, would have basically been beaten. So now they figured out a way to earn medals clandestinely by changing their classification, as if there were no rules of the Olympic Committee that it had to be filtered through before this person was even allowed to compete. So if they were going to complain at all, rather than go after the person that we're speaking about, it would have been better to go at the standards committee and ask what was going on there. The second way it's invalidating is it implies that someone is transgender for an ulterior motive. And that was always the narrative to early cross-dressing. In fact, the statutes were that people who cross-dressed were masquerading as women, and they could only be doing that for an ulterior purpose, which was usually to fool a client into sleeping with them who would not have slept with them otherwise. So the whole idea, it was almost as though they were saying, you're the equivalent of a counterfeiter. You're passing bills that are not genuine. And once again, that is reductive because it implies that the primary thing that we're looking for in a woman is first to have a vagina, and second that she can be impregnated, and third that she can gestate. And all of those things are typical of one period of a woman's life, but not necessarily all women and not necessarily at all ages of women. And unfortunately, when women get older, they sort of fall off the gender spectrum altogether, and all of a sudden they're sort of neuter people that are almost being treated as though the aging woman thing is to be not a repository of wisdom and strength and virtue, but instead to be, well, you're kind of useless. You're a childless cat lady. And that's the worst thing that you can say about somebody, is that they're a childless cat lady.
Hey, what,
yeah, like a certain somebody.
Thing? I think that's Sorry. The best thing you can say about somebody.
Right? I'm happy to be a child-free cat and dog parent.
Me too.
I don't see why, just because I was born with a vagina and a uterus and all that, that I should have to use that to push a baby out. And that's why, you know, I think transphobia really is rooted in misogyny. It's saying that, you know, women are nothing more than baby makers. If you are not using your body to push out a baby, you're not a real woman. And that's why it astounds me that TERFs think they're feminists. I'm like, you are saying that women are nothing more than their reproductive parts. I thought that's what you were supposed to be fighting against. I thought feminism was supposed to be against that. Excuse me.
Amen.
Now, well, here's what's like intriguing. The part that bothers me the most isn't that women have this lovely ability, because I think it is lovely and is to be celebrated. But what frightens me about it is that the presumption seems to be that even if you've had that, and even if you've had multiple children, suddenly after a certain age, you're seen as being something almost like the way we treat movie stars. It's like, in fact, they always say that, you know, you're in trouble as a female movie star if suddenly you're playing the mother of the leading lady as opposed to the leading lady herself. And I forget what's the movie. I think it might have been the one with Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep. Death Becomes Her. I think that was the one. And suddenly Goldie Hawn was chosen to play. She thought she was going to be the leading lady, and she was the leading lady's mother. And this was the worst thing she could imagine. But what do we do as trans people that are in between all of that? First of all, do we marry? How often? When we do marry, what role do we play? Do we adopt? Do we not adopt? There's so many different questions that go into that. And so if it hits cisgender women hard, it hits transgender women harder still. And it also hurts our body image, because I don't know about the rest of you, but especially in my earlier days, I wanted to be curvier. I would have loved to look like one of these uber women that was everything about her was screaming woman, 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 because for one thing, if you had those features, you would not get red, and therefore you would already skip a lot of the problems that trans folk have to go through when they're red. Because when you're red in the old days, that meant total invalidation. That meant, okay, the jig is up. We know you're a counterfeit bill, and since you're a counterfeit bill, you have lost all value. You've even given up the value that you possessed before you became trans, which was the saddest part of all. It was like you can't even go back, because if you go back, you're seen as an inadequate male, which is the other worst thing you can say about somebody. It's the equivalent of how we sexualize women's reproductive organs. We do the same with men. And we say, I'm sorry, if you have erectile dysfunction, well, you're kind of, what are you good for now, you know?
Oh, sure. Well, the good news is that the tide is turning on this anti-trans narrative that's been really focused on us. It's been focused on trans kids. It's been focused on trans athletes. And it's all been driven by the propaganda mill of the Republican Party for the last several years. And I think the tide is really turning. For instance, as we close the first half of our show today, I just want to bring you some good news from Aaron in the morning. Aaron Reed is the transgender journalist who hosts the website Aaron in the Morning, which brings you transgender news. And it looks like Ron DeSantis backed 23 anti-transgender school board candidates in the elections. And of those 23 anti-trans candidates, only 6 won their election. So that's really good news. That means that the, you know, school attacking, trans bashing, anti-queer candidates that are being backed by Ron DeSantis, that means that 17 of them lost. And so that's pretty good. I think that shows that we're definitely, we might be seeing the tail end of this. I mean, especially with how things are shifting with the national election too. So
can I say one other thing at this point? I think it's very important, because we live in a society that sees the whole world as divided between victims and victimizers. And as trans folk, we don't really want either one of those labels. If we are victimizers, we're the bad guys. We're the ones that are trying to move in and steal other people's turf. And if we're victims, then we're just pathetic mental cases, and we don't really get the respect that we are due as human beings, and our achievements become peripheral to who we are as individuals. So we might be achieved something, but it's not because we're trans, it's in spite of being trans. So one of the things that's going to be very hard for us is to be recognized just as people first. And the mainstreaming of trans identity is there primarily to finally say, just see us as human beings. Don't see us as good guys or bad guys. We're neither. We're just people. And then evaluate us as to what we actually do with our lives.
Well, that's a great point. So we're just about out of time for the first half of our show. Nicolette or Sheila, did you have any like really quick last things you wanted to share?
I guess what I wanted to say is I think that this whole attack on trans bodies is, you know, it's an attack on our bodies not looking or conforming to the way that society expects. But as was the case with the cis woman, Imani, you know, if your body in any way looks different from how society expects you to look, like you're a cis woman who doesn't look feminine enough, you're shunned and mistreated and bullied in the same way. I think that this attack on trans people is not very different from just the attack on people who are perceived as quote unquote ugly.
So my closing comment would be that we live in a society that are concerned with symbols and signifiers. And what that means is that we're always showing things. We do it with advertising. We do it with media. There's no doubt that how things appear has a big price tag attached to it, both good and bad. And there's no getting away from that. It only becomes cruel when it becomes completely artificial. And even the people that are the winners in a world like that actually have lost something, because they lose their individuality as human beings to the degree that they become only a sign referring to a value that has really nothing to do with who they are as people. So I always think that the real path to humanization is to get beyond being utilized for something and having people co-opt you either to abuse you or to exalt you, because they both deform you as a human being.
Well, that's it for the first half of Transpositive. We're just going to take a really quick musical break, and then we'll be back with the second half of the show. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. For the second half of Transpositive today, we're going to be talking about the issue of transgender sex work and some of the legal challenges and some of the rights and protections that transgender sex workers deserve. We're going to be listening to some commentary from the Sex Workers and Erotic Service Provider Legal Education and Research Project. The Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project is a diverse community-based erotic service provider-led group which seeks to empower the erotic community and advance sexual privacy rights through legal advocacy, education, and research. What this has to do with transgender folks is that there's a lot of transgender people in sex work. The issue of transgender sex workers and their rights is a complex and multifaceted subject that intersects with social justice, human rights, and public health. Transgender people, particularly those engaged in sex work, face significant challenges and vulnerabilities due to a combination of systemic discrimination, social stigma, and legal barriers. Transgender people face discrimination in sex work, as all sex workers do. Transgender people face rejection from their families, their communities, and workplaces, which leads to increased rates of poverty, homelessness, and unemployment. These socioeconomic factors contribute to the disproportionate representation of transgender people in sex work. And that's part of why it's really important that
transgender people have legal protections in place. It's very dangerous work. People who we read about in the vigils, which we do every year in November, many of those people are sex workers. Sex work for many transgender people becomes a means of survival. Discrimination in the job market makes it difficult for transgender people to find employment, particularly in environments where gender identity is not accepted or understood, as it is in many, many parts of this country. Sex work may become one of the few viable options for transgender people to earn a living. However, engaging in sex work can expose transgender people to a range of risks, including violence, exploitation, and legal repercussions. So we're going to listen to a commentary right now from Maxine Dugan from the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education Research Project. And then we'll be right back. We'll have a little more commentary, and then we'll go and listen to another commentary about policy decisions and what we might expect from a Harris administration regarding the rights of transgender sex workers.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me again for another edition of Dominate the Nation. My name is Maxine Dugan. I'm a currently working prostitute of 30 plus years, and I pretty much plan on working as a prostitute for another 30 plus more. Well, I'm here to report back to you what happened with the Democratic National Convention in regards to sex workers and what happened. So it seems that in 2020, there's always this platform that the Democratic conventions, you know, all the conventions have, and they have a section called Ending Violence Against Women, in which Democrats, you know, are committed to ending sexual violence, domestic violence, and other violence against women. So the 2020 platform voted by the Democratic convention that nominated President Biden included a passage that said, "We recognize that sex workers who are disproportionately women of color and transgender women face especially high rates of sexual assault and violence. And we will work with states and localities to protect the lives of sex workers." So that was removed from the platform, as we found out, by Gustavo Turner, who wrote an article in XBiz and reported that that language was stripped out of the Democratic National Convention platform. So that kind of set the precedent for what was about to come. So also what we saw was this punch down by Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett. She's a U.S. Congresswoman for Dallas, and this is what she had to say in her presentation at the DNC.
"He became a career prosecutor while he became a career criminal. With 34 felonies, 2 impeachments, and 1 porn star to prove it."
So, you know, what's wrong with that language is that, you know, Michael Stabile of the Free Speech Coalition did a really good job. And he, you know, he just kind of called it out, and he was just like, "Hey, you know, you guys would never have had that conviction for Donald Trump without Stormy Daniels. And you know, you guys didn't even say her name anyway." I was just, it was just kind of really, really appalling to me that they would allow, you know, Stormy to be used and our community to be named that way. It was just terrible. And so the last thing that happened, which is another bad sign for sex workers in the upcoming election here, is that there was a youth organizer and human trafficking survivor who got to speak also. And she said that she said this lie that Kamala Harris had helped take down the classified site, you know, known as Backpage. And, you know, that was a lie. Kamala Harris didn't take down Backpage. It was a federal case in Arizona, and that case has been going on for 6 years, and it's in its second trial. You know, what Kamala Harris did is she charged Backpage when she was the state attorney general of California, and she charged them twice in court, and both times those charges were thrown out because they were not substantiated, and she should have been disbarred for that. But here, you know, she has used criminalizing people as a means to further her own career. And, you know, and then she went on to become a U.S. senator. So she is not above using, you know, her power and influence of her elected position to further her own career. Sounds like Donald Trump to me. Because it just is, you know, it just looks like, you know, from this last convention here that the Democrats no longer, you know, are the big party tent. You know, they're ditching the protections for 2 million of us sex workers. And, you know, we're voters. You know, we have families that are voters in larger communities. And apparently the DNC and the Harris campaign doesn't need our vote.
That was Maxine Dugan with the Erotic Servers Provider Legal Educational and Research Project. The legal advocacy that the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project seeks to create change through a combination of litigation, policy statements, and voicing their concerns for the community of sex workers in political arenas. Gender sex workers face significant legal challenges in many parts of the world, including the United States. There are many parts of the United States where sex work is criminalized, and transgender people are at an even greater risk of arrest and prosecution. This criminalization can lead to a cycle of poverty and incarceration, as criminal records can further limit opportunity for employment in other sectors. The legal system also frequently fails to recognize or protect the rights of transgender people, particularly those involved in sex work. Police violence and abuse against transgender sex workers is well documented, with many individuals reporting harassment, physical assault, sexual violence at the hands of law enforcement. In some cases, transgender sex workers are specifically targeted by police due to their gender identity, making them even more vulnerable to rights violations. The legal status of transgender people also plays a crucial role in their ability to access justice and protection. In many places, transgender people face significant barriers to legally challenging their gender markers, which can lead to further discrimination and mistreatment by authorities. This lack of recognition can make it difficult for transgender sex workers to access healthcare, housing, and other essential services. Hi, and welcome back. For the very final part of the show, we're going to be, again, listening to commentary from Maxine Dugan from the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project about FOSTA SESTA and about the Harris administration and, about a potential future Harris administration and how they might approach issues regarding the decriminalization of sex work.
Hi, everybody. It's Maxine Dugan here again with another edition of Dominate the Nation here on the Sex Worker Nation channel. I'm a currently working prostitute of 30 plus years and pretty much plan on working for another 30 plus more. So today we're going to review an interview that Kamala Harris did when she was the California U.S. Senator in 2019 with Roots, where she's talking about the decriminalization of prostitution. So let's review that video now, as it's appropriate, because she is a current front runner for the next president of the United States. So here we go.
Recently, you supported FOSTA. There are many sex workers who feel that that law was insensitive to their lives. What is your response to that?
So FOSTA, which stands for Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, was passed in 2018. She voted for it as a U.S. senator, and then President Trump signed it into law. So that law said that any websites that have anything to do with advertising people that were forced into the sex trade could be held liable under the federal sex trafficking laws. And so that had a chilling effect on all these websites across the United States that were featuring any type of erotic labor, whether it was legal or illegal, you know, like the online content creators or adult film performers or people that were selling lingerie or writing erotica, they all got kicked off these websites. All these platforms deplatformed them, and because they were afraid of being charged with being sex traffickers somehow at the federal level. So that was a disastrous law, because anybody who was arrested under that law could have already been arrested under existing law, under the federal sex trafficking existing laws. They didn't need to deplatform and chill the legal speech of all these people under the guise of, you know, trying to prevent forced labor in the sex industry on these platforms. You know, even prostitution is a legal form of speech. You know, I can say I'll provide sex service A, B, or C for X, Y, and Z. That is legal speech, right, here in America. So that's why the Roots interview is asking her about it.
Well, you should know my history on the issue. I mean, back when I was DA, and remember, I was elected DA over 15 years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. I took office in 2004, and I was advocating then that we have to stop arresting these prostitutes and instead go after the Johns and the pimps. Because
Wait a minute. You do not need to be arresting our customers, and you do not need to be conflating our customers with people who are forcing people into the sex industry. That is way inappropriate. Those are different types of, totally different groups of people, and no.
We were criminalizing the women, but not the men who associated with it and making money off of it and profiting off of it.
So here again, she is associating our customers with profiting off of our labor, our sexual labor somehow. Like, we're giving the customers money? No, that's not the way it works, Kamala.
I started, even before I was elected DA, so this would have been 2000, 2002, a whole coalition that was focused on what I called sexually exploited youth, which other people were calling teenage prostitutes, because the system was arresting these young people instead of understanding that they needed to be in a safe place. And so we advocated for safe houses instead of incarceration.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay, yeah. So when she before she became district attorney in San Francisco, she got herself appointed to this sexual assault task force in San Francisco as part of her rise to power here. And so that sexual assault task force, you know, among other things, my mentor, Daisy Anarchy, who was a stripper in the strip clubs at the time, was going to this task force trying to tell them about how there had been all this prostitution going inside the strip clubs and that the women, the dancers, are being sexually assaulted because customers were expecting that they would be providing all these sexual services. But there was a reason for that. And the reason was that, you know, Kamala's friend, Willie Brown, who was the mayor then, was arresting all these street-based workers and forcing them into the strip clubs to work. So they weren't being arrested for prostitution inside the strip clubs. They were just being arrested for working the streets. So that had the effect of forcing all of these street-based workers into the strip clubs, where people like my friend Daisy was working, doing all these like $20, you know, lap dances. You know, they weren't doing $20 bareback blowjobs. So that created this huge conflict going on inside of the clubs and confusing expectations from the clients. So when Daisy goes to complain to this task force, the sexual assault task force that Kamala Harris is on, and is telling about, you know, these sexual assaults, and they've made police reports about it, and the police aren't doing anything about it, you know, nothing, of course, nothing gets done about it. But instead, you know, this sexual assault task force, you know, goes and sees that there is monies that's put forward to providing this housing for people, youth in the sex trade. And so what that happens is they take $500,000 out of the public health budget and traffic it into this, you know, housing thing, supposedly, you know, for youth who are being forced in the sex trade. And, you know, that house didn't last very long. The funding ran out on it. It was a waste of funding. The Department of Health was mad about it. And it didn't really provide, you know, some stable permanent housing, which is what youth in the sex trade really need. That's what the research shows, right? So, there you go.
These young people. So this is my history with the issue. Mm-hmm. In terms of Backpage, similarly, Backpage was providing advertisement for the sale of children, of minors.
Okay, that is a lie. That is a complete lie. You know, Backpage was not doing that. People were violating the terms and conditions of Backpage and making illegal services available on Backpage. And, you know, the majority of people that were on Backpage were all adults. So Kamala Harris goes on to charge Backpage at the state level when she was the state attorney general here with, you know, pimping and pandering twice. And those charges were dismissed because they had no basis. So, you know, her pursuit, along with some other state attorney generals like Texas, you know, across the U.S., did finally bring a federal case against the Backpage people. It was finally litigated. They were seized in 2018. It's 2024. So 6 years. And so they just went through their second trial in Arizona. And I think, you know, Michael Lacey was convicted on what, one charge? You know, they illegally brought in a whole bunch of people, you know, in front of this judge and jury that, you know, violated the terms of service of Backpage. And then they want to blame Backpage for, you know, being involved in forced labor. So, you know, that's had an additional chilling effect on the adult industry and on your free speech and what kind of speech you have access to now on the internet. Thank you, Kamala. No.
And unlike Craigslist, which said, we're going to stop doing it, the people who are running Backpage basically thumbed their nose at us and kept doing it, making money off of the sale of youth.
So that is a lie. Backpage, once again, they had an MOU, a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Justice to help them provide any information about any youth that were being illegally had ads, illegal ads on Backpage. And they helped in many cases help locate those youth. And when they when Backpage was seized by, you know, the Department of Justice, you know, the FBI had letters that they had, you know, written that said, no, you know, Backpage has been helping us, you know, identify all these people that are involved in forced labor. And, you know, having that website disappear now is going to cause, you know, where are we going to go to, you know, help these people? So, you know, she's duplicitous here when she is talking about, you know, what Backpage's real role in was helping address forced labor in the industry.
And so I called for them to be shut down.
Mm.
And I have no regrets about that. Now, on the issue of providing a safe place for sex workers, I am a huge advocate for that, always have been.
Do you think that sex work ought to be decriminalized?
I think so. I do. I think that we have to understand, though, that it is not as simple as that. It is also about, there is an ecosystem around that that includes crimes that harm people. And for those issues, I do not believe that anybody who hurts another human being or profits off of their exploitation should be admonished or should be free of criminal prosecution. But when you're talking about consenting adults, I think that, you know, yes, we should really consider that we can't criminalize consensual behavior as long as no one is being harmed. But at the point that anyone's being harmed or exploited, then I think we have to understand that's a different matter.
Recently, you supported FOSTA.
So that is part of the issue here with people, with politicians like Kamala Harris, who want to profit off the criminalization of our labor by saying that, you know, oh yeah, you know, whatever adults view is great, but, you know, then they have to make everything else and rename us as sex trafficking victims, rename our clients as sex traffickers, so they continue to do these prostitution sting operations under the guise of rescuing us, when really they're just charging us with prostitution. So the larger effect of shutting down these online workspaces for people in the sex trade, regardless of what part of the sex trade you're involved in, has resulted in forcing people back onto the street, forcing the workforce back onto the street. That's what passing FOSTA SESTA did. That's what shutting down Backpage did. It forced all this workforce that was working online back to the street. And it took all of our customers with us back to the street. So now when you have these, you know, cities that are crying about, oh, you know, there's all these street-based workers in our neighborhoods, la, la, la. Well, you know what? You can blame Kamala Harris for that. You can blame President Trump for that. You can blame all of those Democrats, you know, in the House and the Senate who voted for this bad law and supported the criminalization of prostitution by criminalizing our speech, by criminalizing our online platforms. So in this, you know, particular presidential campaign, we're calling for the decriminalization of prostitution by removing FOSTA SESTA altogether and stop criminalizing our online speech unduly. Have a good day.
And that was Maxine Dugan with the Erotic Service Providers Legal Education and Research Project. What Maxine was talking about there was FOSTA SESTA. FOSTA SESTA was a combination of two bills, the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking FOSTA and Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act that became law in April of 2018. Those bills were intended to reduce human trafficking by amending the Communications Decency Act of 1996. However, some say that the litigation has had a negative impact on sex workers, and especially on LGBTQ people, including trans folks. Some say that FOSTA SESTA has led to the censorship of sex workers' accounts, which can make it more dangerous for them. LGBTQ folks say that it has harmed LGBTQ people by profiling and policing them and removing speech that discusses sexuality and gender identity. So, in conclusion, transgender sex workers face intense social stigma for our gender identity and also for involvement in sex work. This double stigma can result in extreme marginalization, pushing transgender sex workers to the fringes of society where we are more susceptible to violence and exploitation. The stigma surrounding sex work often prevents transgender people from seeking support because of a fear of being judged or rejected by service providers, healthcare professionals, and even our own communities. The fight for the rights and protections of transgender sex workers is an ongoing struggle that requires a multifaceted approach. Advocates argue for the decriminalization of sex work as a critical step in reducing the risks and vulnerabilities faced by transgender sex workers. Decriminalization would allow sex workers to work in safer conditions, access legal protections, and seek help without fear of arrest or discrimination. In addition to decriminalization, there's a need for broader legal forms to protect the rights of transgender people, including the right to self-identify and access healthcare, legal recognition, anti-discrimination protection, and gender-affirming care are all essential components of assuring the safety and well-being of transgender sex workers. Social support and community-based intervention are also crucial in addressing the needs of transgender sex workers. Issues of transgender sex workers are deeply intertwined with broader questions of social justice, human rights, and public health. Transgender sex workers face unique challenges due to the intersection of gender identity and our involvement in sex work, making us particularly vulnerable to violence, discrimination, and legal persecution. Addressing these challenges requires a comprehensive approach that includes legal reform, social support, and community-based intervention. By advocating for the rights and protections of transgender sex workers, society can take significant steps toward ensuring the dignity, safety, and well-being of all individuals, regardless of their gender identity or occupation. You've been listening to Transpositive PDX here on KBOO Community Radio. It is our fall drive season, so I hope that at this time you will consider giving to KBOO, and in just a minute I'll tell you how you can support KBOO. Thanks again so much for listening. My name is Emma Lugo, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your co-workers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KABU Community Radio couldn't do it without you.